Hello, and welcome back to Not Another Science Podcast. I'm Katie, and in this episode, my co-host Kelsey and I talk to Dr. Kevin Guyon, writer and researcher on the intersection of data and identity, and author of Queer Data, Gender, Sex, and Sexuality Data for Action.
Kevin's work relates the recent censuses in Scotland and England and Wales that have included questions on gender identity and sexuality, and more broadly, how we can bring more inclusive practices to data science and data collection, particularly in the context of LGBTQ plus identities.
Before we start, this podcast is sponsored by Griner Bio One, manufacturers and direct suppliers of laboratory and medical products to academia, research, pharmaceutical, biotechnology, and healthcare organizations globally. For details of their extensive product range, visit www.gbo.com. We're really excited for you to hear this conversation with Kevin. It felt like we really covered a lot, so we hope you find it as interesting and inspiring as we did.
Great. Well, thank you both. Lovely to meet you, and thank you for the invite to come speak about my work on the podcast today. So my name is Kevin Guyon. I currently work as a researcher at the University of Glasgow, but also a writer as well. So I authored a book that came out back in 2022 called Queer Data, Using Gender, Sex, and Sexuality Data for Action. So the book very broadly explores the collection, analysis, and use of data around LGBTQ plus communities in the UK. So very broadly, my research looks at data, it looks at identity, it looks at what happens in that interesting intersection between the two and all the kind of politics, power, and history that comes with that.
So how did you end up in this field through your career?
Really a strange journey. So my kind of academic background is actually in history. So I studied history throughout undergraduate, postgraduate. I did a PhD in history at UCL in London. So I had never thought about doing much in data, definitely not quantitative data. My kind of training and methods were very much qualitative. It was around interviews and archives and these types of research methods. I kind of had a pivot, I guess, after finishing my PhD, where I went to work for an organisation doing equality, diversity and inclusion work. So I kind of thought maybe academia isn't for me, but I still want to be involved in working with universities and doing kind of EDI work. I then had this kind of, I guess, light bulb moment while I was doing this work that actually I was getting a lot of questions from people around how do we collect, analyse and use quantitative data, particularly around different identity characteristics, in my case, particularly around gender, sex and sexuality. So I kind of thought there's an opening here, there's a window where there's a kind of a need for more research and more work in that space around identity characteristics and particularly quantitative data. At the same time, excitingly, there were developments across the UK around the design of census questions. So this is maybe back in 2018, 2019. Across the UK, there were going to be new questions on sexual orientation and transgender identity. So I kind of thought, again, here's an opportunity for my research, my work, also my kind of personal experiences as a gay man to kind of think, what can I bring to these conversations? How can I use my research and my writing to hopefully inform the discussions, shape what's happening, and try and kind of develop approaches to data that are inclusive, approaches to data that are actually engaging critically in what data is doing and not doing. Kind of, it's interesting you say career, because I never really see it as a career, but this kind of journey to this point in time has been pretty hasn't been direct. It's definitely been a bit all over the place, but I think actually that's a real strength.
Yeah,
I think this kind of arriving at work around data, work around data science and tech and quantitative data via a background in gender history, I think actually has been a massive asset rather than a weakness.
Yeah, really valuable combination. In terms of the census, what was the actual engagement process like? How were you involved in influencing the census design?
I, as I mentioned, was working kind of outside of a university at that point. I was working for an equality and diversity organisation based in London and then in Edinburgh. So for me, it was kind of a geekish interest in the kind of design process. For a variety of reasons, which I'm not going to get into, the Scottish census in particular was scrutinised at a very detailed level by a particular committee within the Scottish Parliament, who took a real keen interest in the work of the National Statistics Agency in Scotland, and the design of questions around sex, around sexual orientation, and around trans status. So this did give people on kind of both sides of the debate opportunities to contribute in terms of providing briefings and kind of inputting into evidence gathering sessions. I do remember actually the National Records Organization also had kind of stakeholder engagement sessions where they invited feedback and engagement from researchers, academics, policymakers. So in the context of Scotland, there was a fair amount of opportunities for engagement and participation. Running kind of slightly alongside these discussions, there was also something called a Sex and Gender in Data Working Group in Scotland. So this was established by the Scottish Government to look at how public bodies in Scotland collect data about gender and sex. And again, this was a group that provided opportunities for consultation, for stakeholder engagement, for input, and ultimately created a briefing for public bodies on how to collect data about gender and sex as well. So there's definitely been a lot of space for conversation around these topics in Scotland. Which has been kind of interesting as well, that these discussions are not unique to Scotland or the rest of the UK. And increasingly we see them taking place around other parts of the world, particularly countries where they run a national census. So we see similar discussions in places like Canada and Australia and New Zealand, who have either already added or are in the process of adding questions around sexuality and trans status as well. So again, it's kind of zooming out from what's happening in, say, Holyrood or happening in Edinburgh, I think it's really exciting and interesting to think about how these same discussions about how do we count, who do we count, and why do we count are taking place around the world. I think my work around LGBTQ identities and data is a nice kind of case study for broader discussions around identity more broadly. So I think we could have the same conversations around how do we capture data on race, around disability, around class, around gender more broadly. So I think it's a nice kind of entry point for broader discussions about how do we create categories, how do we analyse different groups and categories and classifications, and who kind of determines these groupings, who is the person in power to go, you're in, you're out, you're going to be grouped together, you're not going to be grouped together. In terms of data visualisation, you're going to be presented in the graph or you're not, you're going to be kind of excluded or omitted. So I think it's a nice entry point for these broader discussions. I think LGBTQ identities are also interesting in that some aspects are definitely fluid or definitely changeable or definitely kind of mutable, but some aspects also aren't. There are many LGBTQ people who have kind of fixed, kind of unchanging characteristics. And I think what's been interesting to see how this kind of maybe division or these splits within the larger LGBTQ plus umbrella have kind of been demonstrated, I think, through some of our recent data collection exercises. So one example I'll share is around the census, for example. So there is a kind of sense that the census does count people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, straight, cisgender. Where it struggles is people who don't fit those neat categories, people who maybe are gender fluid, who are non-binary, who maybe don't have a clear sense on how they wish to identify or kind of something that they can pin down at a specific time and date. So I do think there is kind of, in my writing, I look at how certain methods which are sold to us as being inclusive can sometimes only count parts of larger communities or larger groups. And actually, it can be quite dangerous because while we see something, whether it's a scientific method or a data collection approach, bringing some parts of the LGBTQ community into view, those who maybe don't fit those kind of neat boxes or those kind of tight binaries, actually the work is often a bit harder because we're now trying to say that, yes, some people are included, but also some people aren't included. So I think for me, kind of looking at questions of sexuality and gender and sex through the prism of data, and particularly quantitative data, opens up these bigger conversations about, is it possible to ever design a method or a survey or a scientific approach that captures everyone? Or even with our best intentions, with the best design methods, there are always going to be some people who don't fit into this pre-designed system. And the kind of ethical, political decision about when is it good enough? When do we have a method that works? Are we saying that when 90% of people are included, 95%, 99%? or are we always going to settle for methods which in their design are always going to exclude some people? So I think there's that kind of ethical, kind of political dynamic in this work as well.
Yeah. Would you say more qualitative approaches that you mentioned, like stories and interviews, can have more of a help in shaping views of things that can't be categorized as easily?
Yeah, I think definitely. I think often when we speak about qualitative methods, we're often more common, or we're more comfortable thinking about questions of emotion, questions of kind of bringing yourself, your own biases, your own baggage to the types of methods you're using, the kind of history and the politics that come with these qualitative methods, whether it's interviews or focus groups or testimonies. I guess what I want to do with my research and my writing is kind of really argue that these same issues should be given consideration when using quantitative methods as well. That actually, just because you're designing a survey or aggregating different categories in a data set, this also comes with decisions about who counts and who doesn't count. So I think we're definitely more comfortable seeing qualitative methods through that lens. I think we're a little bit more reluctant to kind of challenge the objectivity of quantitative methods. And I think there's a long history there around numbers and the types of kind of scientific approaches being seen as more kind of harder sciences or more objective, more compared to stuff which is maybe being seen as more emotive or more kind of human orientated. So I guess what I hope people get from reading my book and my work is just thinking critically about all of these methods, whether or not they're quantitative or qualitative.
And so you mentioned this kind of difference between how the, like, hard sciences, I guess, are seen and like this more qualitative work. Do you think that the modern day data science has been affected heavily by like historically more sinister figures who have been very much categorizing people or like focusing on eugenics or trying to fit people into very narrow boxes?
Yeah, fantastic question. Really, definitely 100%. I wouldn't describe myself as a kind of data scientist, but I do in the book definitely explore some of the history on kind of how we got to where we are. So there's a chapter on history. So I kind of traced how we got to where we are around LGBTQ data in the UK. And I think it's impossible to write that history without thinking about, as you mentioned in your question, histories of race, histories of eugenics, these historical approaches to categorizing, counting, managing different populations, and how the intentions of the scientists or the figures behind these campaigns, it often or it rarely was with the good intentions of the people being counted at the kind of heart of what they wish to achieve. So I think particularly the history of race science and the history of categorizing race and its uses for eugenics projects definitely plays a key role in how we should be thinking about LGBTQ data in the present day. I also kind of am interested in what data exists historically about communities who we might now describe as LGBTQ. So again, I thought actually, if we go into archive and look for quantitative data around gay men, for example, what type of data can we find? And as you might imagine, the data that exists historically about these communities is very one-sided. It's extremely negative. It was collected for particular purposes around monitoring crime, deviance, psychological maladjustment. These kind of, a lot of the data that exists was not to highlight the positives or the kind of the roundedness of these communities' lives and experiences. And I think that's a really important point when we think about kind of current day developments around data science, around machine learning, around algorithms, around big data, around these gigantic data sets that make use of a huge amount of information about these communities, a lot of it historical information. And we can very clearly see and very quickly see how, whether it's ChatGPT or kind of these generative AI, how in their design they have these biases baked into them. And that's because of history, it's because of what came before us. And again, thinking how do we unpick that, I think it's impossible to think about our kind of present day data situation without going back and looking at the history of how we got to where we are.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, there's a lot to learn from. Do you think there's any specific points that modern day data science should be looking to acknowledge in terms of using kind of population data, whether we should be acknowledging that the kind of a lot of these methodologies were developed by basically eugenicists?
Yeah, I mean, definitely I'm a fan of disclaimers and kind of data caveats on everything we present. And I think it's also a dimension to thinking about how do these different communities relate and engage to agencies, organizations, institutions who are collecting data about them. So again, we might think if you're, say, conducting a scientific experiment or running a survey or asking people to share information about themselves, there might be reasons why certain communities, certain minoritized groups are not that keen to be sharing data, engaging in these research projects for a variety of historical and political reasons. And I think rather than describing these groups or communities as difficult or as hard to reach or as just a group that's kind of has somehow evaded your research, actually, I think there's a sense of acknowledging why certain communities might not wish to share data about their sexuality with the state, with the police, with healthcare providers. So again, thinking about how that those historical relationships, I think, inform the present day. I think kind of in terms of what can people do about it, I guess something which I am trying to explore and argue in my work is, first of all, there's no easy solution. There's no kind of quick fix, which is probably unsurprising. But I think it's also the sense that we might be misdiagnosing the problem and building solutions from a misunderstanding of the problem. Mm. So what I mean by that is, I think there's a sense, particularly in some parts of the data science community, that simply adding more categories, adding more people into the data set, adding more stuff into machine will fix these problems. And actually, just adding more might actually not ever address the source of the problem. So as I kind of mentioned earlier, we might always miss people. There might always be some lives and experiences that cannot be computed by the system, the kind of data approach that we're adopting. And adding more and more categories might not ever resolve that inbuilt, inherent tension. So we've seen this in kind of some approaches around whether it's adding more response options to surveys around gender, around sexuality, around sex. I think generally it's a positive to have questions which reflect the community they're trying to reflect. But in my work, in my kind of writing, I argue that more and more data isn't going to solve the problem. So sometimes we actually need to not see this kind of the tensions in our system as something that can be fixed away just by bringing more people into fold. Actually, we might need to kind of get into the deeper inner workings and really kind of rip things up from the bottom, which is a bit more of a bolder, radical approach to how things might change.
Yeah, so changing approaches, your work talks about the concept of queering data. Can you explain a bit about what you mean about that?
Yeah, so the book is called Queer Data, and I do hope that it provides a kind of an accessible introduction to work in this field. So there's been I would say not a long history, but definitely around maybe 5 to 10 years of work around LGBTQ data in the UK and the US, from academics, from social justice activists, from practitioners working across a range of different fields. And in the book, I kind of bring together these ideas to kind of argue that queer data can be understood in two ways. So on one hand, we've got data about LGBTQ communities. So this kind of maybe what comes to mind first when you think of queer data. So what data exists on LGBTQ people in education, in healthcare, in employment, whether it's quantitative or qualitative, kind of the data about us part of the kind of formulation. And then the second strand of queer data, which I think is probably a little bit more interesting, is thinking about how do we, in the kind of the verb sense, how do we queer different research methods? So this kind of strand of queer data applies to people doing any type of research. So you may or may not be engaging in topics around identity. It could be stuff around fishing, farming, nuclear fusion. I'm trying to think of just examples not related explicitly to LGBTQ lives. So whatever area of science or research you're working in, I think there's a space for queering the method to use. So by that, it kind of engages ideas from queer theory and queer studies. So kind of a very broad discipline from the kind of late 80s, early 90s onwards, which kind of gets you to think critically about kind of what do we know, how do we know, who do we know, kind of the deep questions around how do we construct knowledge, how does power shape our ideas around who counts and who doesn't count, and how do we apply that in the design of different methods we use in our work. So I think for me that area is really rich for further development. I hope in the book to kind of bring those two strands together and kind of provide ideas that I hope are accessible for people wherever they are on this journey. So they could be somebody who's been studying queer studies for 10, 20 years, or it could be somebody who is just brand new to this, keen to think critically about their approach to maybe equality and diversity work or their approach to designing an engaging survey. I think wherever you are on this journey, there is definitely space for just thinking critically about actually, is what you're doing working? Is what you're doing actually helping the people you hope to be helping? Or, as I also kind of argue in the book, there are a lot of hidden harms as well. So kind of avoiding, just because stuff has an EDI veneer or a gloss to it, actually within that, there can be a lot of risks and dangers that can sometimes make things worse rather than better.
Yeah. And carrying on from that point, for the censuses that have come out recently for England, Wales, Scotland, they've included information about trans people and people of different gender identities. I think particularly for like England and Wales, there's like a thing where you can like zoom in to like a particular area and see how many people of that identity live in that area, which is kind of terrifying if you're one of those people and you know now that there's like a larger visibility for you. So how do you balance making sure people are counted but also making sure that this doesn't affect their safety or their ability to just live their lives as they normally would?
Oh, another fantastic question. I think just around the kind of the politics of visibility is a fascinating, fascinating topic, particularly when we think about it through the lens of data and data collection. There has been censuses past few years across the UK, and we haven't yet got the data from the Scottish census. There has been quite a lot of data published from the English and Welsh census, and for me, particularly interesting data around sexual orientation and around transgender identity. What we've seen also at the same moment where there's been lots of positives about kind of having these questions added, there's also been some dangers that, irregardless of what number was going to be published on the size of particularly the trans population in the UK, irregardless of the number that we arrived at, for people opposed to trans inclusion, the number was always going to be both too high and too low. The kind of politics of data, I think, has really been crystallized by something like the census. And I think we need to have conversation, we need to be speaking about whether the benefits of being counted, so the benefits that come through being included in a national census, whether they outweigh the risks, the downsides, the energy and resources that I know many LGBTQ people and groups and community organizations have had to put into addressing the kind of increased visibility that have come with the addition and the debates and the politics around these questions. I'm not going to go too much down a kind of path here, but particularly in the context of England and Wales, there were issues around the kind of the figures that were published around the size of the trans population, whether it was correct or whether it was an overestimation. At the same time, my argument in my work is that when we're capturing data on minoritized communities, for example, LGBTQ people, it's always going to have an inbuilt undercount because for a variety of legitimate and valid reasons, many people will not wish to share that information in a census. So that's part of the design in the process. There's always going to be an undercount. So again, whether it's an undercount or an overcount or whether the figure miraculously is exactly correct, I think we need to think about the kind of the fallout of this and the toll on people's lives, whether it's labour and resources around responding to regular hit pieces in the right-wing press or around this increased attention to kind of whether or not the percentage is correct. I think we need to ask, does it matter as well? Like, actually, can we direct resources that improve the material conditions of people's lives without knowing exactly the percentage of trans people who live in Manchester or Liverpool or Brighton? I think, I'm not sure. I don't know if we need necessarily to have all of that information to actually address the problem and the problems that people face in their day-to-day life, and whether this, to some degree, might just be a misuse of resources. So I'm on the fence, I think, at the moment around that. I think visibility definitely has many benefits, but it also brings a lot of risks, dangers, but also takes down a path where it's not necessarily responding to, I think, the biggest issues in people's day-to-day lives at the moment.
Yeah, I think particularly on an individual level, visibility of trans individuals can be quite dangerous, really.
And I think, like, just on your point as well, I think we don't know where the direction of travel for this country. Mm. And so, like, at this moment in time, I do believe that the statistical offices are keeping the data safe. It's kind of under lock and key for 100 years, these individualized accounts. But in terms of the kind of current political climate in the UK and around the world, this kind of data set of LGBTQ people,
yeah,
in 10, 20 years' time, it might be terrifying to think what could happen. So again, we can't predict the direction of change, but again, thinking through how, when you make the decision to engage in a data collection exercise, the questions were voluntary, so people have the choice to engage or not engage. There was always going to be a risk involved with that, and people had to be aware of the potential risks that could come with sharing information in a national data collection exercise with the state on your sexuality and gender identity.
Yeah. Well, you always have to weigh the benefits of data collection versus the trust that you have in the institution to protect that data and use it for the reason that you offered it in good faith, I guess.
Yeah, I think it is that kind of weighing up game, because I don't want to be too doom and gloom, but there are also positives as well. And I remember speaking at an event around in Scotland around the time of the census, and I thought to myself, actually for me, I was really excited about the opportunity to mark in the census that I am a kind of gay man living in Edinburgh on that date, and thinking in 100 years' time, somebody will be in some archive opening up, I'm thinking a dusty folder, but by then it'll be some sort of like hard drive or some digital kind of log of some sort. And just have that period in history reflected for future historians, future archivists, future tellings of the past, I think is a really meaningful element to that as well. So I think definitely on a personal level, there is something for many, many individuals, and myself included, something really meaningful about that. So I think it is that weighing up game of the benefits and the risks, and thinking where do you feel comfortable, and acknowledging that many people for a variety of reasons won't, and then that is not a problem. That they should not be forced or coerced into disclosing information about themselves that they don't wish to disclose.
Yeah. Because, yeah, it can be quite affirming. And even looking at that map that Kelsey mentioned from the England and Wales census with the data visualization, that was quite cool to look at and see just how centred on universities a lot of it was, because it's kind of younger generations. And, I thought that was really interesting looking at the data at that point. But, yeah, obviously, looking on the flip side, it's kind of terrifying if it was pinpointing individuals. But it's more population data that you'd hope wouldn't actually be honing in on that. But
and I think with all these topics we're speaking about, there's no right or wrong answer, and I think the kind of there's no one way to do any of these approaches, there's no one way to queer methods, there's no one way to apply a kind of queer data approach to your work. I think it's all just thinking through these nuances and complexities, and particularly with kind of scientific methods that are often seen as objective or as kind of above politics or above history. Mm. I think it's just having space to have these conversations that actually things are messy and complicated and have good points and bad points, but just having a space to have those discussions.
Yeah.
So how important do you think it's obviously important, but what's the best way for people to kind of bring in those groups that might not be well represented in the places where they're making decisions about how data will be collected? How do you bring them into like the inner circle of the data intervention aspect so that they feel they're being represented in a good way?
Yeah, so I'd say that kind of these, there's no one size fits all solution to any of these kind of challenges. And I think the stuff we can do in all of our work, in all of our projects, in all of our research that makes the work more inclusive, more accessible, more engaging, that's going to help folk from minoritized communities and everyone else in your research or your project actually designing survey questions that are clear, accessible, and that engage as many people as possible is only going to be a positive. So there is quite a lot of work, particularly in the quality, diversity, and inclusion space, that provides advice and guidance on how to just design approaches that are engaging and inclusive. So I think it's definitely better than where we were 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, where these methods just assumed a kind of default human subject, a white, cisgender male. We're definitely getting to a place where people are starting to realize that people's lives are different and diverse, and we should be trying to design approaches that capture that diversity. So I think that's definitely a good thing to be doing. At the same time, I don't think that's going to solve every single possible problem and issue. I think designing approaches that are inclusive might at some point reach hurdles where we go, even though we've tried our best, it's still not working. And I think in those moments, we need to think more critically about, should we be doing it? Do we need to do it? Do we need to undertake the study? Do we need to collect more data about these communities? What are we hoping to use this data to achieve? I think those kind of more critical questions which take us into spaces around data abolition, around the politics of refusal, around thinking critically about our role as researchers, as scientists in this space and the power that we bring, I think that's also something we have to have at the back of our mind alongside these kind of diverse and inclusive fixes as well. So I think the two can run in tandem. I don't think the kind of EDI fixes are going to solve everything, but they're definitely going to make things better than they were kind of historically.
Yeah.
What do you think is going to be happening in the queer data field going forward? What are you looking forward to? What are you slightly concerned about?
I guess I'm trying to think like my kind of crystal ball, thinking what might happen next. So my work is kind of continuing in the space, but kind of zooming out a bit. So I am currently writing a second book, which I'm almost finished with the first draft of, which looks more broadly at kind of how do different systems categorize and classify LGBTQ communities. So whereas queer data focus specifically on data and around how do we collect, analyze, and use data, with the next book, I'm more interested in how do systems that we might not normally see or associate with data kind of make sense of different LGBTQ communities. So the book looks at hate crime reporting, it looks at dating apps, it looks at kind of rules around asylum and borders, it looks around film and TV funding, a real mix of different systems, but how they all in similar ways kind of capture information about LGBTQ experiences and then make decisions based on that information, and how those decisions can often have winners and losers in terms of who benefits by being counted and who is kind of pushed into shadows or excluded from these systems. So that's where my own research and work is moving into. In terms of the broader kind of queer data space, I think what's exciting is just seeing the appetite for these ideas. Both people working in fields around kind of gender, sex and sexuality, around data, but also in other kind of spaces and places. So I've done quite a bit of work around, say, data protection in the past few months. So again, people working in privacy and data protection and how these questions or this kind of querying of methods might apply in their work. So I think there's definitely an appetite for thinking critically about these kind of questions. I think some of it is pushing back against more kind of mainstream approaches to quality, diversity, and inclusion work. I think kind of challenging some of the stuff that we've kind of been around for the past kind of decade or so around EDI work that maybe isn't working, that maybe isn't making the situation better. So actually feeling emboldened to go, why are we spending time and money on these EDI projects if they're not actually addressing the communities we want to be helping and benefiting from? So I think queer data kind of help, and I hope empowers people working in that space, particularly that space around data, which is a big aspect of kind of EDI work. So yeah, I think that's kind of me, where I think stuff might be going. I think also what I would love to see as well is kind of as much as possible these conversations happening outside of academic circles and outside of universities. I know we're on a university podcast, but I think doing this work around data around LGBTQ lives, my hope is that it's engaging people across many different workplaces, many different organizations, many different activist groups, and actually thinking that this isn't something that should be reserved for academics working in queer studies. This is actually something that, whatever your job or role or context, there can be something in it for you. And I hope that's what the book adds to, and these conversations that kind of, yeah, go beyond the university context.
Yeah, it'll be exciting to see it more widespread across society and not just, you know, people in university cities.
Yeah.
Drinking their coffee.
Exactly. And I think that's one benefit of something like the census as well. So again, I spent a lot of time bashing the census, but that kind of visualization that you spoke around is a really great way of sharing information that's accessible, engaging, interesting to look at, and is definitely reaching people beyond demographers or kind of geographers or people working specifically in those fields. So again, thinking how do we communicate these ideas in ways that's exciting and interesting, because I think it's a really interesting topic. So yeah. I think it's about how do we communicate it in a way that reaches and engages as many folk as possible.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, it's also interesting. When do you think we're due to expect the results, or the sexuality results anyway, from the Scottish Census?
I'm not sure. So I am hoping maybe early 2024. Okay. So the census in Scotland took place almost a year exactly after census in England and Wales. And they published their data, I believe, in January of this year. So if we're operating exactly a year behind, we'd expect the really high level results by maybe, say, the first quarter, I imagine, of 2024. It'll still be a while before we get the more detailed stuff where we're kind of working across different characteristics or kind of aggregating certain pieces of data. But that kind of high level count of X percent of people in Scotland identify as LGBTQ, I imagine in the kind of early part of 2024.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah. Apart from obviously buying your book, which everyone should do, how else can our listeners find you?
The book, definitely. And I know for whether it's students at University of Edinburgh or elsewhere, you can generally get a copy free online. Most libraries tend to have a digital copy online via the university library. So if you don't fancy buying a copy, please grab a free copy to download online. For me, I'm kind of trying to keep a low profile at the moment and just focus on writing. But I think just giving space for those ideas and those thinking, I think for me, I really enjoy the writing process as well. So actually having had this time to work on the second book has been really great, I think, to kind of give myself time to kind of think through these ideas and think through actually what's happening when we're classifying, counting, managing different identities and communities and groups.
Thank you so much, Kevin, for such an interesting and important conversation. Everyone should go and buy or download Queer Data now. Hopefully Kevin's work can help us all think more critically in science and in life. I'm really excited for the second book as well. It sounds really interesting.
And we actually have another data-related episode coming up with Professor Ruth King, whose work relates to counting the uncountable. If you have any questions you'd like to suggest for us to put to Ruth, please let us know by getting in touch.
If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a follow on Spotify or wherever you're listening to it, so you don't miss the fab guests we have in the work this season. Coming up, we have episodes on how to set climate targets, the Northern Lights, and our episode with Ruth on counting the uncountable.
This podcast is brought to you by Edinburgh University Science Media, bringing you exciting conversations about the science being done by our very own staff and students here at the university and beyond.
We're a student-run society with lots of opportunities to get involved if you are an Edinburgh-based student, so keep an eye on our social media. There are lots of chances to write, edit and illustrate for our magazine. We're on Instagram at USci Media, Twitter or X at USci, as well as Facebook and LinkedIn as Edinburgh University Science Media.
Any feedback or suggestions for the podcast are always welcome. And this episode was hosted by Katie Pickup and me, Kelsey Tetley Campbell. The podcast logo was designed by Apple Chi, and the podcast episode art was designed by Elizabeth Carmichael. The intro music is an edited version of Funkarama by Kevin MacLeod, and the outro music is an edited version of Footballs in Space by Professor Colin Campbell.
Thank you for listening, and until next time, keep it science.